6:13. Some nice cotton candy colored skies as the sun comes up. Crescent City Connection lit up in blue for the most part because some of the lights are out, and I got to get that fixed if you're going to pay to sponsor the light color, right? Anyway, it makes you think that fall's coming eventually, even though it's hotter than get out. And Jeff Palermo joins us now. Before you know it, Jeff Palermo, we'll be getting ready for LSU to play Clemson.
Yeah, we're getting there. We're getting there. We're less than 2 weeks away, right?
Yeah, Crazy when you think about it, but it's good in another way. Tell me what LSU's been up to.
Actually, less than 3 weeks away. So, yeah, we got a little bit more. Well, Saturday had LSU had its first scrimmage. Media was not allowed, but Lane Kiffin did give us a description of what they saw, and he's talked about how the defense dominated first. You know, they went one-on-ones, meaning starters versus starters. Defense came out strong in that game, but he liked how the offense rallied and played better as the scrimmage went along. Sam Levitt, according to Lane Kiffin, showed off some of his mobility, and in fact, the social media team for LSU football put out some really short clips of the scrimmage, and in one of those clips, you get the sense that Sam Levitt scrambled into the end zone for a touchdown, and a reporter asked Lane about that yesterday, and he was a little surprised that that was out there in the public realm. And if you go find, or if you go try to find that practice video or that highlight video today, you're not going to find it. They took it down.
Really?
Everything is being played very close to the vest right now, Tommy. But he also did mention that Harlan Berry had a long touchdown run in that game, and there were no major injuries. There were several guys that did not practice yesterday or were not at practice, at least during the media viewing portion, but nothing significant really there to report, according to Lane Kiffin. So sounds like they got a lot done. You know, one of the major focuses, I think, at this point, you know, obviously is you're trying to get your starters ready, but I think the other thing that Lane's really trying to build is depth, trying to make sure that, you know, not only are they pretty solid along the starting lineup, which on paper they appear to be, you know, building that depth, I think, is a big thing. You know, one thing that, you know, Lane did mention was the pressure that the defense was able to get on Sam Levitt early on. So something I think, obviously, there's always these concerns with the offensive line, and I think a lot of LSU fans can just remember to the last couple of seasons and how mightily that unit struggled, and they're really hoping for an improved team but on the offensive line. But I would say that, you know, LSU's got some really good pass rushers, and we've talked a lot about these freshman defensive linemen as well, so that might have been a part of it. Kind of hard to really analyze it too much since the media was not able to put their eyeballs on that scrimmage.
Tell me about the offensive line, because I didn't really ask you about that, about starters and about depth.
Well, starters, you know, obviously it starts with Jordan Seaton, the offensive tackle. He was the guy they brought in from Colorado, second team, all Big 12 player last year. I think one of the mock draft projections had him as a top 10 pick next spring. So you're looking at a potentially dominant player there. Very well-spoken kid. I had an opportunity to speak with him last week. So he's kind of the leader there, along with Braylon Moore, who returns as the starter. Bo Bordelon is a starting guard, former Newman star who's been on the team now. This is his fifth season, and he's finally getting an opportunity to start. And Lane Kiffin said earlier in camp that he truly has earned this opportunity. So far he's beating out Devin Harper, who was a transfer from Ole Miss, who was a standout high school player at Calvary Baptist up in Shreveport. You got Alou Ba, who's a transfer in from Maryland, who I think last year only gave up like one sack. He seems like someone that's a kind of a plug-and-play type of guy, and I think they feel really good about him. And then Weston Davis has been the guy starting at right tackle for them. And Weston Davis certainly had his struggles a season ago. But this kid's a five-star prospect, and there's some talent there. And I think there were probably some people that were surprised that Lane Kiffin kept Weston Davis, but they saw something there, and we'll see how much better he is this season.
It does take some time for the offensive line to gel as a unit, right?
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, and this kind of also goes into just the team, you know, trying to gel as a whole as well, right? I mean, I think that's been one of the things that, you know, we've talked quite a bit about is with 60-plus new players trying to get everybody on the same page. It seems, you know, Lane kind of likes what he sees so far with that. He feels good, but you're never really going to know until this team is put into some true adversity moments, and you know how they react at that time is then you really get a true gauge of that.
You got a nice piece about Blake Baker written at WWL.com. Talk about that, Jeff.
Well, Blake Baker, of course, you know, had an opportunity to be a head coach at a couple different places last December. Tulane, which is his alma mater, Memphis was the other one. Lane did a great job in retaining him, and I think probably the message was to him was, hey, you know, stay here. We're going to win at a high level here, and then when that will allow you to build your resume, and then you can go get a head coaching job then at a Power Four school instead of having to go to one of these mid majors. And you just never know at a place like that, right? You just it could turn on you. You know, you lose. You don't know where you're going to be supported financially. Maybe there's some promises made, but they don't come through. All those kind of things. Why don't you take the Kirby Smart route, right? You know, be a coordinator, and then wait for that really good job to open, and that let that be your first head coaching job. And it's worked out well for Kirby Smart at Georgia. You know, even though this is his first head coaching job, he's built has one of the best college football programs in the country. And I think that was what Lane told him, hey, that might be a better route for you. And of course, you know, he got a nice contract extension at Blake Baker. And the fact that you have a lot of the same offensive assistants together that were at Ole Miss last year, and a lot of the defensive assistants, there's some new guys. There's Chris Kiffin, Lane's brother, who's now coaching linebackers, which allows Blake Baker to be, because Blake was both defensive coordinator and linebackers coach under Brian Kelly, so that gives him an opportunity to really digest everything about the defense and not have to necessarily micromanage what's going on with the linebackers. So that's freed him up a little bit. And he's a guy that feels really good about this group. I think everyone is, you know, one of the storylines has been these three freshman defensive linemen, and Deuce Gerald and Richard Anderson and Lamar Brown. And that is awesome to know that you're going to have three freshman defensive linemen playing. It's awesome in the fact that that's great for 2027 mm-hmm. and 2028, but what about 2026? These kids are going to go through some growing pains. They're going to find out this is not high school anymore at points during this season, and there's going to be times where they are going to be humbled at times, and how is that going to impact their defense? And I think that's a big concern. But one of the things that Blake said too is that they've really been able to build up some depth, especially in the defensive secondary. We talked about the emergence of Jace Thomas pushing to Marcus Cooley for playing time at one of the safety positions, and they've also feel like they've been able to do that at defensive end. Dylan Carpenter is a guy that's been around in this football program for a while, and Blake talked a lot about him, about how he's really becoming a nice little depth piece behind Prince Will Umanmielen and Jordan Ross.
All right, let me take a quick break. We'll pick it up. We come back. 6:22 traffic now, WWL. 6:28, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. Somebody texted in, can you ask Jeff about Coach O and what's he up to with LSU? So I'll ask Jeff Palermo right now, hey, what's up with Coach O and LSU?
Well, very interesting. He wasn't at practice on Monday, and Ed Orgeron said he's not been feeling well. And from what I understand, he also wasn't at the scrimmage on Saturday. So, and Lane kind of half-jokingly said, you could have imagined that conversation when I told him, you know, it's best that you be at home right now. Mm-hmm. So I think Ed Orgeron wanted to be out there, and he you know, this is probably a time of the year that he really loves. You know, it's preseason camp. The guy loves, you know, coaching the finer aspects of being a defensive lineman, and this is when you can really get into the nitty-gritty about it, and he's not out there. So practice is tonight, the next practice, and we'll see if Coach O is back out there. But I think it's been a great addition because, you know, now with all these analysts that coaching staffs, and Blake Baker was asked about this last Friday about just how huge the staff is. I mean, you literally can have three different guys coaching a position unit. Like they'll have three different defensive linemen or defense. You know, Sterling Lucas is one of them. Ed Orgeron's another. They'll have another coach out there as well, kind of coaching these guys up, and it allows you to get a lot of reps in. Right, you can really break up that unit, whether it's the linebacker unit, running back, defensive back. When you have all these coaches out there, it really allows you to do a lot more in a short period of time. And then, you know, one other thing about that scrimmage last night, they ran 170 plays, which gives you an idea of how fast-paced a Lane Kiffin offense is.
I heard that Sam Leavitt got in the end zone.
He got in the end zone, but you're not going to be able to see it.
No.
You can look all you want. You could search every social media channel that you know, but you're not going to be able to see it anymore, Tommy.
That had to be something when he found out it was out there.
I can imagine the conversation he had with somebody after that press conference.
Are you out of your freaking mind? All right, thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
All right.
We'll come back, talk about the Omni Hotel at the Convention Center right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. It is 6:46. We're joined by Cameron Henry, Louisiana State Senator and Senate President, to talk about this hotel for the Convention Center. How you doing, Cameron?
Morning, buddy. How are you?
I'm all right. You know, it seemed pretty simple where you just, if you could build a hotel, you put up the money, you build a hotel, and then if you make money, fine. If not, fine. But it's not that simple when it comes to this, is it?
No. The structure of this deal is different than most I've seen as it relates to a hotel. And this is something that was put in play several years ago with the contract that the Expedition Hall signed. And we're just trying to sort through it all to make sure it's the best interest of not only the city and the state. I mean, this has, you know, 45-year ramifications on it. And I don't think people have taken the time. I think now they are. I think now they've taken the time to realize, you know, what the long-term expenses are, the exposure is for everyone. So I think at the end of the day, we're going to get there. I just think, like everything else, at least that I like to do, is I'd like to make sure that everybody understands what we're agreeing to. And then if they like it, then we'll vote for it and move forward. But we'll have no surprises in the future.
To be clear, you're not against the hotel. You're just looking at the whole funding mechanism and the timeline and everything else, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, we know that it's important for us to have new hotels in the city of New Orleans. That's a need that the NFL has expressed as relates to getting the Super Bowl in 2031. And if you want to go after your bigger conventions that are lifeblood around here, we have to have that. And it's a need. Like, we know we need it. Therefore, we're offering up, the Expedition Hall is offering up $120 million in incentives for them to build the hotel here. That's a lot of money for a hotel that's going to make money that we know we need, right? I mean, it's not like we're asking for a speculation business to show up and hope it makes it. I think if a new hotel comes here, odds are it's going to do well. And if that's what the market requires now, meaning we're looking, I know I spoke to the governor yesterday, and he's asked the groups to go look at what other states are doing. And if the market now requires incentives for people to build hotels, that's what the market dictates. And so be it. Let's make sure these incentives are on par with what everybody else is doing.
That's my question.
We don't want to be an anomaly.
Yeah, that was my question about the market demanding, because if the hotel is going to make money and it's a garden spot for a hotel, why do they need incentives in the first place? You would think Hilton or who, I don't know, give me a hotel company, would say, no, we want to build there. You don't have to give us anything. Just let us build a hotel there and the rest will take care of itself. But that's not the climate.
Well, that's what we're kind of working through that now. That's why we continue to kind of delay a little bit to make sure we get all the information and make sure that it's everyone's, you know, the Omni's position is going to be to get the best deal for the Omni and their shareholder. I get that. I appreciate that. But our job is to make sure we're getting the best you know, the best deal for the taxpayers, both on the local level and on the state level. So we're just slowing it up again, and everybody's gathering more information. And historically, the more information you have, the better decision you make. And that's all we're going to do. I think we'll be able to work with the folks from the Omni, who I've met before, and I'm working with a lot of the folks in New Orleans to make sure that this deal works long-term for the city and the state. And I think we'll get there. We just need to make sure people understand how long this deal goes for. 45 years is a long time to dedicate sales tax, and to make sure that, you know, it just makes basic common sense, and get a look at what other states are doing. And I think if we see that other states are doing the same thing, we'll move in that direction. If we seem to be a little bit more generous than most, and then maybe we have to go back and, you know, renegotiate with them a little bit. But, you know, I think everybody's going to work in good faith.
And that's an interesting comment, because it is a competitive environment with Austin and Dallas, and I know some other cities in Texas, other cities around the country. But has any other hotel company expressed an interest in building a hotel there besides Omni, or do you know?
I don't have the information on that. You'd have to talk to the Expedition Hall folks on to see if this was a competitive bid where we bid out who wanted to build it, or did Omni approach Archer? How did that relationship begin? I would think that it would be pretty easy to get somebody to build a hotel in downtown New Orleans, because we need them so desperately. But maybe I'm not a hotel person, so I don't want to speak as if I know more than I do.
So what is your major concern here, Cameron, about the deal?
Well, I mean, I think when you're if the state doesn't help the Expedition Hall out, then they're on the hook for $120 million. That's an enormous amount of money for them to be on the hook for. And usually Expedition Hall at some point in time is going to need renovations and so forth. They're just going to come back to the state and ask us for money, because they don't have the money because they're doing this, right? They're going to use this money to get the hotel, and they'll be short money somewhere else. There's also a line in here that if the council, if the city council doesn't pass a pilot program, which is going to kind of guarantee a minimum tax, The hotel is going to be taxed at the average rate of all the hotels now, not as if it was a new hotel. Mm. Obviously, if it's a new hotel, it'd be taxed more. If that doesn't work, then the Expedition Hall will owe the Omni an additional $2 million a year for the next 45 years. Mm. That's an enormous amount of money. So at some point in time, and this is what I'm working with Mr. Berger on, Dale Berger, good friend, we're hopefully going to meet up today or tomorrow to break down exactly who's paying what. And does it equal a good deal for the city and for the state? Because it seems like we're subsidizing a lot of this hotel, but the hotel is going to make money. We both know that. So we want to make sure that this is making sense. And I'm sure people listening probably are pausing for a second and going, man, a hotel in New Orleans is going to make money. Mm-hmm. Usually the revenue you generate pays off your debt, and then over time you make money once your debt's paid off. This is the state and the city paying off the debt, and obviously the hotel is going to still collect revenue. So we want to make sure that number balances out. But look, I spoke to the governor yesterday about it, and this isn't something where he said, look, I'm mad at New Orleans, we're not moving forward. This project does not fall in that bucket. So I can assure everyone it's not a vendetta of any sort. This is just trying to figure out all the term sheets of all the money that's supposed to flow. Is the stadium and expedition going to participate in this or not? Is the city of New Orleans going to come up with cash? Or are they just not going to collect taxes in the future? All these things are very legitimate questions that need to be answered. And, you know, I'm working well with Mr. Cook at the convention center. So everybody's doing their part. It just, look, this is a complicated deal. And kind of like how you started off this conversation, usually hotel deals are you build them, they generate revenue, you pay off the debt, and you move forward.
Yeah.
This is unfortunately isn't that straightforward, but we're going to get it there.
But that is an ideal location, is it not? Would you not think?
Yeah, next to the convention center. Yeah. Yes. Short of being on Bourbon Street, I don't know how. I don't know.
I don't either. That's why I wonder. you know, you talk about political tensions, mad at New Orleans, but the governor wants a Super Bowl. He knows this is integral to getting another Super Bowl. So the tensions between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, they don't really apply here, do they? Or do they, Cameron?
No, not at all. And look, the Super Bowl is an important economic driver for the city of New Orleans, but I think everybody needs also to step back and think about how much time and effort, at least from my side, we have put into focusing on a hotel that's going to be built in 2 years on the off chance that we get a Super Bowl mm-hmm. in 2031. you know, the city and the state is going to help with this, whether I think whether the city likes it or not. We have got to find other economic engines for the New Orleans area. If the city is going to be where we want it to be, and a hotel is important and the Super Bowl is important, but that's the main focus right now of everyone. Think about it. This is a hotel, probably take 2 years to build roughly. And we're trying to get a game in 2031. We've got to have something in between that gap, right?
We've got to
be working for more on the Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 companies that we really need to start focusing on that, not just strictly tourism.
Not to mention 45 years of tax rebates after that Super Bowl, right?
Well, that was my logic, is how many Super Bowls are we going to get in the next 45 years,
yeah,
right, to pay for this? And if that's the only reason we're doing it, which I don't think it is, we're trying to get other conventions. But as you see, the return on investment of what we've done in Richland Parish, where with that data center there, those teachers, because of local sales tax collections, were able to get a $50,000 bonus,
yeah,
or check. I mean, that didn't go to just Republicans and Democrats. That went to every teacher up there. I got that. The state is now looking at that as a model for, okay, what from a local sales tax collection, what are you going to be able to put back and help your local? So we're going to work through it all, but I think we're going to get there.
Thank you, Cameron. Appreciate it. Cameron Henry, Louisiana State Senator and Senate President. We'll take a break. Come back. 6:55, 5 till 7. Traffic now, WWE. 7:14, quickly to Dr. David Elias, an orthopedic surgeon with Ortho LA. Morning, Doc. How are you?
Good morning. Fine.
Tell me about hamstring injuries in general. First of all, the hamstring is one muscle or a group of muscles?
It's a group of muscles in the back of your thigh, basically running from your butt down to your knee.
Okay. What is a pulled muscle as opposed to a torn muscle?
Well, everything probably means the same thing. When you hear pull, sprain, or tore, or mm-hmm. a tear, all of that means the same thing. The hamstring muscle can, let's just call it a tear, or a sprain. First of all, we usually grade them either mild, moderate, or severe. So they also can tear from different spots. They can tear from the bone, either from the attachment at the knee or the butt bone.
Mm-hmm.
Most hamstring tears happen in the mid part of the back of the thigh, so it kind of tears where the muscle attaches to the tendon. But I mean, like any other injury, they're different degrees, but they can be a tough injury to recover from.
So what happens with the muscle that causes it to tear? It gets overstretched or what, Doc, or gets in a position that it shouldn't be?
I think it's usually it happens from a sudden contraction. You know, as you use the muscles, they lengthen and contract, and the sudden force from when you go from a lengthened muscle to a contracted muscle,
mm-hmm.
sometimes that can cause the rupture of the muscle fibers, and it can happen. You know, you usually see it with people doing a sudden burst, whether they're running fast or stopping and making a cut. But that's typically how you injure the hamstring. It also can happen with a weird twist or turn or sudden twist or turn.
To be clear, the doctor has not looked at. I don't think you've seen Jordan Tyson, have you?
I have not.
No, so we're not talking about him. We're just talking about hamstring injuries in general. Why are these so problematic, doctor?
Well, they're just one of those injuries that can linger for a while. They're not a career-ending injury. Typically, probably 90% of them don't require surgery, but it's just one of those injuries you can take 4 weeks off, you can recover, rest, go to therapy, stretch, do all the treatment for it, and you can come back and feel great, and a week later, it can re-tear. So you kind of take one step forward, two back, and so it can be one of those lingering injuries. And again, that depends on the degree of the tear. It depends on where the muscle fibers tear, what part of the leg.
Is there a difference between a pull and a tear or not?
There's not.
Okay. So when you say pulled muscle, you actually tore it.
Anytime you pull or sprain your muscle, you're tearing muscle fibers.
I gotcha. So again, the reason these tend to reoccur more than other pulled muscles, or do they? Or is it just that we get hamstrings get our attention?
I think once they heal and the athlete has enough time to let it heal, in other words, they're not trying to return back to their sport too quick, then I think they can finally recover from it. But I think what you see in athletes a lot is, you know, we recover them, we get them back, and, you know, we think they're ready, and then they can tear it again. And so then they just, one of those linger. Now the second time they tear it may not be as severe as the first time, so they may only miss 2 weeks the second time, but then they come back, and then, you know, they're at risk of doing it again. So I call it one of those season-long nagging injuries. Mm-hmm.
Being an idiot layman as I am, I would think, well, why don't we just surgically repair this and then make it strong, put like a patch on a tire or something like that where we surgically reattach it and then put some extra strength, whatever you call it, sutures in there, something like that, but it doesn't work that way?
Not really. If you tear it from the bone, then typically you have to go reattach it with an anchor.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a long recovery. That's about a 4 month recovery, because you got to let the tendon heal back to the bone. We do things like, you know, we can do some things to speed up the healing, like PRP injections. I think that's very common in athletes. Most collegiate and professional athletes who get like a hamstring or a quad sprain, we will a lot of times inject, it's called PRP, platelet-rich plasma, and that's just your own blood. You spin it down, you get all the good growth factors, and you inject it at the site of injury, and that can help the athlete feel better, but also, you know, theoretically you're putting fertilizer at the injury site, hoping to help it heal.
These are professional athletes at the top of the game. Are they more prone to something like this than the average Joe?
Not really. I mean, I do think certain people, certain body types are more prone to hamstring injuries, but sometimes it can just be unlucky. It can happen to anyone. You know, they do. I'm sure most professional athletes are doing the proper stretching before and after to help try to prevent it. Also, you know, having good nutrition, having good hydration, all of that helps prevent these injuries too.
Doc, when it comes to body types, are there certain people that can you, as a physician, I'm not talking about Jordan Tyson here, but in general, look at a guy or a woman and say, yeah, that's predisposed to this or predisposed to that because of the body type or the alignment of the hips or the thighs or what have you, anything like that?
Not really. There's not a classification for putting people into a category where they're more prone to tearing their hamstring. But, you know, a lot of times on your pre-season physical exams, you're testing the range of motion of the hip and the knee, and, you know, we'll notice, man, you got tight hamstrings. And so you wonder if people who just naturally have tighter muscles are more prone to these injuries. I think there's probably some truth to that.
Why is that? Why are some people just like, you know, I call it muscles of steel, where they don't work out and they just got these muscles that are, you know, I got in an arm wrestling contest with somebody, my arm was sore for a year, and the guy never lifted a weight in his life, but just had these steel muscles. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I mean, they're different muscle fibers, and not everybody's body is made up of the same composite of muscle fibers. And then, you may have somebody who has an underlying back problem, and that can give you tight hamstrings and maybe predispose you to having a hamstring sprain because of the way of because of the problem with the back. It's making you change your mechanics of your lumbar spine, and that can cause some tight hamstrings too.
So the way your spine is shaped can cause some problems with that?
Or if you have a underlying spine issue, whether it be a herniated disc or a little arthritic segment, or you could have, you know, scoliosis, things like that.
We're talking to Mike Dottilia yesterday, and he talked about the need to get to the underlying cause of soft tissue injuries. That's what we're talking about here?
There are definite, maybe in different parts of the body where you can blame it on a cause, but mm-hmm. a lot of these injuries are just, you know, they're eccentric contractions that just happen kind of very unlucky.
What does that mean, eccentric?
Eccentric is the part where I was telling you when the muscle is lengthening and then all of a sudden you go make a cut and you're contracting the muscle too fast, and that transition from going to a long to a short muscle contraction is usually when you'll see these tears, whether it be your calf muscle, your Achilles, your quad, your hamstring. It's all the same mechanism.
And this has nothing to do with Jordan Tyson, but in general, once you do tear this hamstring, and again, pull, tear, the same thing, it depends on degree for those just tuning in, are you more prone to this for the rest of your life?
Not necessarily. I think that once you finally give your body the time to recover, and as long as you're doing all your stretching after, I don't think it means that you're going to have this your whole career. I think what we see a lot of times is people will deal with this injury, you know, for a whole season, no matter the sport. And that's probably because, you know, we're recovering them. They're doing good. We're trying to get them back. And the muscle's just not ready to come back. So I think you do see a season nagging injury, but not necessarily a career nagging injury.
And I know we have to go, but how do you rehab that without re-tearing it?
So, I mean, the first thing you do is just rest. So let the muscle fibers calm down. And then once you start to get healing, then you get into therapy, and they can utilize techniques such as stretching and scraping, and they can do dry needling. Mm-hmm. So really you treat this with physical therapy. And again, most people get PRP injections too.
Is it one step forward, two steps back if you come back too early?
It can be. Mm-hmm. That is the problem.
Thank you, Doc. Appreciate it. I appreciate your time as always. Dr. David Elias, orthopedic surgeon with Ortho LA. We'll talk to Steve Geller next half hour, WWL sports director. Disappointing news about Jordan Tyson, the Saints' number one draft choice. And a lot of people, when they drafted him, thought, you know, you might be getting an inferior product here. Not about his ability, but just in terms of being injured. 7:25 traffic now, WWL. All right, 7:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by our good friend Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing all right, Tommy. Staying cool inside.
Yeah, amen. I hear that. Tell me about, what was the feeling among the media there when Jordan Tyson pulled up with the hamstring?
Man, you know, it was during that joint session on Thursday against the Jaguars. You saw him running up the sideline after a catch and then get pushed out of bounds. And he lands awkwardly, ends up tripping, lands awkwardly, and just stayed face down on the sideline there. And you just knew and felt that something was pretty seriously wrong with him. And now we find out this hamstring issue is going to, you know, carry 2 months at least for him. And you're going to wonder, how does this affect his timing now, his, you know, total assimilation into this offense? Just trying to build that chemistry with the quarterback. So many concerns now with a guy you invested obviously heavily in with the 8th overall selection. And then, I mean, you knew going into the draft and selecting him all the injury history that this just turned 22 years old on August 12th, I think it was. Just he's been through throughout his career, from knees and collarbones, ankles, and the hamstring issue.
All right, so as they say in the movie North Dallas 40, can't worry about that now, Poot. Let's talk about who we can deal with. Tell me who steps up now. A preseason game, who got your attention with the receiver position, and what is it looking like for the first couple of months of the season?
Yeah, obviously I think Chris Olave's target load ends up getting even greater now with Jordan Tyson down. You still have Devon Vele in the mix as well. And I would think even tight end Juwan Johnson, you're going to see an uptick and targets for him while Tyson is on the mend. But yeah, with the younger wide receivers that this team has, thankfully they did draft two other rookies in this year's draft class, and Bryce Lance and Barrion Brown, who we've been seeing a lot of good things from at camp. And Brown, you know, showed out as well in the preseason game against the Jaguars. Lance was kind of held out. He was dressed, but they didn't put him into the game because he was nicked up, as Coach said, so they were kind of holding him back. I'm expecting to see, or hear, I guess you could say, hear about him today at the joint workout with the Dallas Cowboys. And then some other receivers on this roster, you know, Trey Palmer, Bub Means, Ronnie Bell, Kevin Austin Jr., curious to see now if they can step up even more. Bub Means is a guy that has been around. This is year three for him. More of a big target kind of guy, not the same athlete that Jordan Tyson was. And just he's been building that rapport with the second team offense. We'll see if he can maybe, you know, crack his way into that first team. But right now, I would definitely think going into the season, you're going to be looking at more of a Chris Olave and Juwan Johnson heavy targets with Tyson down for a couple of games.
I'm thinking about doing my hair like Bub Means did. What do you think?
That'll work.
Yeah, I think it will too. Tell me about a running back and what got your attention. That it's hard to tell because none of the starters were there, but among the backups, who got your attention at running back on Saturday?
Man, I think everybody loves what we see from Audric Estime, just hoping that his ankle issue isn't too serious and that he's back on the field, because, man, you saw the vision for him, that running with intention, just that 9-yard scamper to get that touchdown. I think he broke like 3 or 4 tackles to get into the end zone. And with question marks still with Kendra Miller and Devin Neal, there's definitely a spot right now where I would have him as the third running back on this team if his ankle issue isn't going to keep him sidelined for a while. You have C.J. Donaldson, the rookie, who, man, oh, man, he had a tough go, the undrafted rookie out of Ohio State. But you look at the power that he can provide you. I thought he could be a short yardage guy for you, but it just seemed like the defense of the Jags knew what was coming there. And I don't know. It's a curious, you know, do they end up looking at more in that, the running back free agent market, which isn't very good at all right now.
Did Estime bulk up on the offseason or not?
I think everybody, you know, comes back looking a little more thick and swole because of the, you know, nowadays these guys are doing so much workouts on their own. It's not something that I overly, you know, was like aware of though, with him coming into this season. I just know that he's obviously trying to carve out that spot and looking to be that number three guy. And then obviously Ty Chandler is another running back I didn't mention. We saw him used also in the special teams, open the game with that big kick return for the Saints. And I don't know, I thought the Saints would run the ball more against the Jaguars, but I guess the success that they were having with, you know, Wilson at quarterback, they kept throwing the rock. And that's which worked out for him because everybody's buzzing about him right now.
That's what I hate about preseason, because you don't know what they're trying to do, what we're trying to do. 7:51, quick break, and then more with Steve Geller when we come back. Traffic now. 7:56 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with WWL Sports Director Steve Geller talking about the Saints. Steve, what are we going to do about that kicker position?
I'm sorry, what was that, Tommy?
What are we going to do about that kicker position?
Man, looks like right now that, you know, Charlie Smith is just having a tough go, and you would think that Tanner's got the lead right now in this competition from what we've seen. But I mean, Tanner Brown doesn't have any NFL experience. We know he's been in the UFL. Curious to see if once some trim downs among some other rosters are being made with these other kickers, because everybody's got two right now in camp, if they end up looking somewhere else. But then the problem is, you know, that's not really a big turnaround going into the regular season with somebody that hasn't been in your system. I don't know. You know, the kickers, it's a funny thing with something gets into your head, and Charlie Smith has just been having this rough go, especially man, you just looked at that extra point in the game, and it had you concerned right off the bat.
That was like a professional bowler throwing it in the gutter, and then it comes out, and it for whatever reason hops out and knocks the pins over, and it's just at that level you would wonder, well, wait a minute now, if he's capable of that at this level, what does that portend for the season? And I got no confidence in Charlie Smith. I hate to say that. I like him a lot. I think he seems like a nice guy, but when I see that extra point and God Almighty, I don't know. I don't know what you do. I don't know who's out there, who's available or not. And again, you know, it's like the big leg is good, just like availability. It's like, well, if you can't get it between the uprights, you're not going to really do me any good, you know? So I don't know what they're going to do there. Tell me about the defense. What impressed you about the defense after the game on Saturday?
Man, that first half was definitely exciting to see. You know, that continues to carry over. Gotta love what everything has been putting together between the pass rush, the takeaways. Really curious to see more of a guy in linebacker, Jalen Ford, who seems to be coming into his own year two with his Brandon Staley scheme, was able to get that pick, and just love the speed you see from him on the field. Another guy that you're hoping can stay healthy, a fifth-round pick that this team had in 2024 that continues to try and prove himself. But overall, a lot of good things, and someone too, and Martin Emerson Jr., who has been really, I feel like, rising up the depth chart, because he kind of was slow going early on coming back from injury. But after a rough outing from Isaac Yiadom, I feel like Emerson is definitely your number three corner right now.
Are they going to come back just to play Dallas and then go back to California? Do they come back to New Orleans, or do you know?
Yeah, they're going to come back to New Orleans, then go to Dallas to play the Cowboys, and then come back here. So the Black and Gold will have some training camp sessions, like the one at Tulane at night will be coming up.
So when do the joint practices with L.A. happen?
That'll be on Thursday.
Oh, I got you. All right. Thank you, Steve Geller, WWO Sports Director. Well, hotter than hot can be today, as it has been, with highs between 95 and 100, a chance for showers. They had around Belchase yesterday afternoon, rain all over the area, but we didn't get a drop. But it rained in some areas, I think, pretty good yesterday. Highs of 95 right now. We're already at 82 degrees, another extreme heat warning today. Greg Upton joins us, our guest, our friend, the director of LSU's Energy Institute, talk about wind in the Gulf. Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Doing well. Good morning, Tommy.
So I guess if you were to talk about a day where the sea is like glass and there's absolutely, and we see days like that on the lake where there's no movement at all, just still, that kind of would be an accurate metaphor or analogy for where the wind industry lies offshore of the United States right now. Accurate?
I think that is fair. The winds have certainly shifted, if you will, for the wind industry over the last few years in the U.S. You might recall in August of 2022, then-President Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act into law, and part of that was expanding offshore leasing for wind, as well as renewing some really important tax credits for wind that was really going to make those projects economically feasible. So they went through, a series of lease sales from 2022 to about 2024. And how that works is companies that are interested in developing that offshore wind, they're going to bid on those lease sales in the same way that they bid for offshore oil and gas production. They were bidding for the right to be able to build out wind. And then the federal government got upfront bonus payments for that. So the company would pay the federal government for that, the right to do that. And then ultimately there would be a royalty coming back to the federal government. In January of 2025, when President Trump came in, as you've covered multiple times, there was really a shift away from wind. There was some changes to permitting that some of the companies were saying that, hey, look, we signed these leases, we paid these bonus payments, and now you're telling us you're not going to move forward with these permits. Even if we're complying with the law, and again, this sounds really similar to what the Biden administration did with offshore oil and gas when he came into his term. And so a lot of kind of parallels here with that policy uncertainty. And then what you saw is, the Trump administration, of course, there was going to be legal challenges with this, et cetera. So the approach that they took was kind of interesting. From about March all the way up until the most recent announcement, one by one, the Trump administration has been negotiating with these projects and saying, hey, look, we know we're probably not going to move forward with the permits for this. There's probably not a path forward for you to get the project done. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to give you the money back, and you're going to invest that money into oil and gas infrastructure and electricity infrastructure in the United States. And so that's what we've seen. We had Total in March, Blue Point Wind and Golden State Wind in April. In June, you had Invenergy and Duke Energy, and then the most recent example was RWE this last few weeks. And so in total, it's about $3.9 billion that the federal government has given back to these projects and said, hey, look, we're not going to permit it, but we're going to give you your money back, and with the agreement that the companies will go in and invest that into other energy infrastructure within the U.S. So that's where we are.
So given back being the key word in that, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So the federal government is writing a check, if you will, back to the company. The logic, though, and again, I'm not defending one way or the other, but kind of the economic logic is that if these wind projects came on, they would be receiving very large subsidies that were passed in the Inflation Reduction Act. And so because the projects will not be moving forward, they will not be receiving all of those tax credits for those projects. And so that's kind of the argument is, hey, look, we're going to give you your bonus payment back, but you're not going to develop the project, and now you're not going to get those subsidies that you would have gotten had you built the project.
So I guess what I'm wondering is it a net loss to the U.S. Treasury to pay them not to develop wind offshore?
I have not run those specific numbers. I would really need to. I was actually thinking the same thing this morning when I was prepping for this. It would take a little bit of calculation for that. But, you know, Tommy, for you, we will run those calculations for our energy outlook that's going to come out in November.
Do that.
And I will do that for you.
Well, because it's interesting, Greg, if we would be paying, if we're going into our pockets to pay them not to develop wind. It's one thing to say, okay, we're going to have a moratorium, we're not going to do it, or we're going to take away the credits or whatever. Here's your money back, no lease, no harm, no foul. But to actively go into the Treasury and start spending government money to pay them not to develop wind, that's a different animal, right?
Yeah, that's correct. My understanding is that that the federal government simply gave them the money back that they had already paid. Okay. That's my understanding.
All right, we'll take a break, pick it up. We come back, 821 Traffic Now, WWL. 826, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Greg Upton, director of LSU's Energy Institute, talking about wind power, for all intents and purposes, being dead under the Trump administration. And to lump a couple of texts together that I've gotten here, Greg, somebody pointed out that the government pays farmers not to grow crops, that oil and gas is subsidized as well. Talk about that, if you will, please, about oil and gas being subsidized and the subsidies compared to what wind was going to get?
Yeah, so the way that an economist really thinks about it is, what is your net tax burden, okay? And so you could think about, oil and gas. There are certain tax treatments for accelerated depreciation and those kind of things that some would consider a subsidy. I think in net, it is fair to say that oil and gas is a net payer of taxes.
Okay.
And certainly a big payer of taxes. For wind and for solar, for instance, it's the math is a little bit more ambiguous. So historically, we've had these production tax credits and/or what are called these investment tax credits. The production tax credits, for instance, are essentially equal to the revenues that a lot of these projects have received historically. And so the price of electricity, let's say it's $25, $30 a megawatt hour in that range. The production tax credits historically were about $25 per megawatt hour. And so kind of the net of that is, it's easier, candidly, to make the argument that wind and solar have received more aggressive subsidies than oil and gas when you think about it in terms of the net tax burden that's there.
What about capital investment in Louisiana companies that might get caught in a lurch between, well, we were going to do this, now we're not going to do this, who knows what's going to happen in the future? Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's the really difficult thing, is this policy uncertainty. And all across the entire energy value chain, whether you're talking to your molecules company, an electrons company, regardless of what part of the value chain you're talking about, it's a very capital-intensive industry. And with capital-intensive industries, you bring together many investors. The timeline on those investments, even to build them, oftentimes take years. And then once they're built, the payout for them is going to happen over many, many years. And so when there's policy uncertainty in terms of, okay, well, when this administration comes in, are they going to change the rules? And then it swings the other way. That makes it harder to build out that energy infrastructure. And ultimately, again, regardless of where you are on the value chain, it makes it less likely that that infrastructure is going to be built here and placed here in the United States. And so that is the biggest concern, I would say, that energy companies tell me, is that policy uncertainty and how they're going to respond to those policies when they change.
Why not both?
Well, that's a policy decision, right, that the voters can tell their elected officials, hey, look, we like all the energy and we would like it to be abundant. And, you know, we want policies that are consistent across administrations. But, of course, that'll come down to what those political decisions are.
Reason I say this, as a young broadcaster, I was kidding around about the space, the Hubble spacecraft, saying that the money was wasted when the telescope wouldn't work at first, remember? And somebody called me and said, actually, that's not true, because that money that was spent was turned over in the economy. It paid for salaries, it paid for groceries, it paid for this, paid for that, paid for the other thing. So just because something is subsidized, that doesn't mean economically it's a bad thing, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. You can use subsidies strategically. And you know, you brought up farming earlier. That's a good example. It might be a good policy in the United States to say we're going to have the ability in order to grow all of the food that we need domestically. Is there a cost to that? Yeah, there's a cost to that. We're going to have to subsidize farming. And that's, in essence, what a policy decision that we've made in the United States. And so if there's, you know, these kind of national security issues, for instance, you know, it can make sense in order to do that. And energy is a good example of that as well. Do we want to have the domestic energy production here in order to ensure that we have access to energy? Energy's pretty close to food in that regard. Can you imagine if you had to go you know, a week or a month without access to electricity or transportation fuels? That would really be, you know, impact us a lot. And so those are policy decisions that can be made for sure.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it. Director of LSU's Energy Institute, Greg Upton. We'll talk to J.P. Moreau when we come back about that Plaza Tower and what's taking so long. Right now, time for WWL First News. A minute late for that, we go to Ian Ozan. 8:46 now, 14 till 9. Tommy Tucker joined by Councilman J.P. Morrell. J.P., how you doing? Good morning.
Good, Tommy. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Newell and I were having a conversation off the air last week about the Plaza Tower, just, you know, in general, talking about what an eyesore it was because it didn't blend into the rest of the skyline of the city. It kind of is an outlier standing there. I can remember when the building was opened. It was the thing, man. This is hot stuff for New Orleans. Times change, though, and that building certainly, and after the tragedy on Saturday, of course, that, you know, it was closed off building. Nobody should have been in there. I understand that. That's of little comfort to the family of the young man that lost his life. But tell me about the building itself. What kind of legal hurdles is the city facing to have something done with this, JP?
Well, actually, the building right now, Tommy, is under a demolition order. As you know, about a year and a half ago, we went to court with the Yeager estate and we won the right to put a demolition order in. We had a group evaluate the building and it was proceeding towards demolition. In the interim, a local developer came in with a third party out of town and asked for us to pause the demolition order while they went to secure financing to look at the possibility of converting it to a housing complex for like upscale senior living. Now, the original request of the owners was they wanted us to lift the demolition order. We did not lift the demolition order. We suspended it because the difference is, Tommy, if we had withdrawn the demolition order, that would have required us to go back to court later on to get the right to demo the building. So the building's under a demolition order.
Let me slow you down a little bit. So the owners, the Yeager estate, wanted you to rescind the demolition order?
Yes.
Because they were selling it to a third party?
Right. And the thing is that from the city's perspective, that's happened a couple of times with different owners where they go, hey, we're looking to sell this property, pull the demo order off because it'll impact the ability to sell it. But in this case, because the Plaza Tower has been such an egregious eyesore, we're like, nope, we'll give you the time to try and sell the building. But if this sale falls through, we're tearing it down. So the demo order is in place. It was legally sued over. We won. It is in place and it is on hold, barring this group coming back to show they have the financing to purchase and do the building. That window is closing very quickly because we gave them about 18 months. And I want to say, I'm thinking off the top of my head, Tommy, they probably have 2 or 3 months left to show the financing is going to happen. And if it doesn't, we go right back in the demolition queue to get it torn down. Now, I do want to warn people, there is certainly a significant cost. The estimated cost to demo that building is around $20 to $30 million. And that's going to be capital spend from the city that has to be spent to demo the building. And as you can imagine, Tommy, even if we secure the plot of land from the Yeager estate because they can't afford to reimburse us for the demo, that plot of land is not worth $20-$30 million. Mm-hmm. So if and when we demo it, and if this financing falls through, we're gonna demo it at a loss, a pretty significant loss.
What is like the property worth, JP? I have no earthly idea.
I'm not a real estate broker, mm-hmm. but I believe when Yeager bought the property, he bought it for a couple of million dollars. It can't be worth much, Tommy. I mean, the main value of that building is, I mean, obviously, if it were to be redeveloped by a third party, there are historic tax credits tied to the building. And if and when the building's demoed, those historic tax credits go away. But the only value to the site, because the site's not even particularly large, mm-hmm. it's not even like a full block, it's a weird site, is the height. Because obviously, because of the height of the previous structure, because of the location, you could build a high-rise structure back there. I mean, there certainly has been some challenges because, as you can imagine, there are reasons why the lots around the site are vacant, and that's because people don't want to develop next to the site until they know what's happening with the site. Because, as you know, South Market comes up till about a block away from Plaza Tower, and then it stops, and there's basically parking lots there. And there's been a lot of interest in doing that development, but with the current status of Plaza Tower, no one's going to take a flyer on building some beautiful project next to a derelict building.
Hey, let me take a quick break. We'll come back with J.P. Morrell, New Orleans City Council Member, 851, 9 till 9, traffic, WWL. 857, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to J.P. Morrell, New Orleans City Council Member, talking about the Plaza Tower building. J.P., the text line's exploding here with people saying, don't tell me the Yeager Estate doesn't have the money to get this torn down. Why does the city have to pay for it? They got grant money for the building, et cetera, et cetera. I presume the due diligence has been done and the estate does not have the money?
It's not so much that the estate doesn't have the money. The reality is that our basis for tearing down the property is that it's an imminent danger of collapse without any kind of remediation. So we, as the city, all we can do to get the property demoed and get it done expeditiously is for the city to step in and do it. If we wait on the Yeager family as a private entity to demo the building, that could take years of future litigation. So like we have the excuse to demo the building because we can say it's an imminent danger of collapse. And obviously there have been parts that have fallen off and it needs to be shored up if it's going to be rehabilitated. But it's more of an issue of timing, Tommy. I mean, if we wait for them to demo the building might demo itself.
Is there recourse after the fact to get the money back?
That's basically when you have to do a hostile demolition of a building, you put a lien on the building or the property for the cost of the demolition, which is why the assumption that we have as the city is that they'll just turn over the keys to the empty lot because it's not going to be worth the value of the demo.
So Is there, I guess it all depends on what happens with this third party, and do you, is the clock ticking on that? Do we know, like,
the,
when?
The clock is ticking on that. They're under a time constraint that we gave them, that they had around 18 months to try and figure out how to get to the financing done, and that clock is coming up pretty soon.
All right, any final thoughts, JP?
No, I mean, it's unfortunate. I mean, it's a historic piece of property, Tommy, but as we've said, I mean, as you and Newell said, it's like one of the biggest eyesores, dirty dozen, dangerous pieces of property in the city, and either it needs to get developed or it needs to get erased.
Yep. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. J.P. Morrell, New Orleans City Council member. We'll talk with the president of the New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation about emergency response drones, and we'll thank you. Into the 9 o'clock hour we go. Melanie Talia joins us, president and CEO of the New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation. Talk about drones. How you doing, Melanie?
I'm well, Tommy. How are you this morning?
I am okay. Tell people that don't know, perhaps, about the New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation.
Sure. We've been around for 30-plus years. Our mission is to make New Orleans a safer place to live, to work, and to play. And we do that through a variety of means, mostly training, advanced training for our police officers, and providing equipment and supplies that, for whatever reason, are just not in the municipal budget.
And some of those equipment and supplies, I guess it'd be somewhere between manpower, equipment, and supplies when you're talking about drones, huh?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the drones in some places are the wave of the future, and in other places, drones have been around for a really long time. But they've impacted public safety in tremendous ways. They've really made a difference in the cities where they have been used. And we've even seen that here in New Orleans with the fleet of 9 that we've had for about 2 years now.
So what are you guys going to do? What are you donating or providing?
So the city is looking at drones as first responders. So when a 911 call comes out, while an officer might be dispatched, an officer may not. The first responder to that scene or to that call would be a drone. And it's DFR is the short term for it. Mm-hmm. DFRs are being used around the country. And
drone
being
first responder, I'm guessing?
Yes. Okay. Yes, drones as first responders.
Gotcha.
You're being used extensively in our neighboring parish in Jefferson. So the city is looking at a pilot project, drones as first responders, in the NOPD 8th district, which includes the French Quarter.
So I'm trying to figure out how that works. So the drone goes out, and does it interact with the people, or it just takes a picture or shows the people back at drone control what's going on, and then they figure out from there what they need to do?
More or less, that's more or less how it works, Tommy. Yes, so the 911 call comes out. A pilot who is in the command center will launch the drone, and the drone will fly immediately to the scene of that call, and the drone will be able to assess the situation. It may be a situation where a police officer is not required. It could be someone who needs mental health services or some other service. That doesn't mean you need to dispatch an officer, in which case officers can go about their business doing other things. If it is a scene where an officer needs to be dispatched, of course, an officer will be dispatched. It's a great tool, and we've seen it used oftentimes to track a fleeing suspect. So obviously the drone would be able to see a fleeing suspect much more quickly than would an officer who's on the ground, be that officer on foot or in a car. And of course, we all know that the French Quarter gets mighty crowded sometimes. Mm-hmm. So the drone can get from point A to point B much more quickly. Obviously, it avoids all the foot traffic and the vehicular traffic.
So how expensive are these things, Melanie?
Well, it varies depending upon the drone and how many drones you have and how many docking stations you have and how you anticipate using them. Mm-hmm. The pilot project that the city is considering has a price tag all in of about $750,000 over the course of 5 years.
And how many drones are we talking about?
Ideally, it would be 4. I mean, 1 is great, but, you know, drones have limited flying power mm-hmm. and limited flying time. So in an investigation might take longer than that drone is able to stay up in the air. So it's always good to have at least 1 backup. But we're looking at, ideally, we would have 4.
So they like $250,000 each?
Give or well, 750 over the course of 5 years. So yes, give or take. That's a kind of a round number, yes.
And I'm just, you know, my kid's got a drone. I certainly hope it didn't cost that much. This is some kind of, I guess, commercial grade or something. I'm just trying to figure out the drone thing here, why it's so much.
Yes. It would be a commercial grade. One, and they would be funded exclusively with, at least the three that we would fund, are funded exclusively with private monies. There's no public monies involved here. It's a pilot project. The drones can fly about 20-ish, 25 miles maybe per hour. They can stay up about 20 to 40 minutes depending. So they obviously have capabilities that go beyond the, you know, a drone that we might just have at home for our children or to take out to a picnic somewhere.
Mm-hmm. What does NOPD say about these things?
Well, the New Orleans Police Department is definitely on board for drones as first responders. Captain Palumbo in the NOPD 8th District has been spearheading the project on NOPD's behalf.
And these are primarily used as first responders or only as first responders?
Absolutely. They are used as first responders. You know, I think there's a lot of confusion about license plate readers, sometimes referred to as LPRs. Folks are talking about facial recognition. They're talking about surveillance. That is not drone as first responder. A drone as first responder, the device sits in its docking station, or for all practical purposes, its battery. When the 911 call comes out, the drone is launched by a pilot who flies it directly to that location and then does whatever needs doing to manage that scene.
Tell me about some of the other needs of NOPD and what you all are looking at.
Sure. You know, one of the things we recently launched was the Emergency Medical Responder Program. There was a gap in public safety where emergency medical services are not always allowed into a scene. That's their official protocol because the scene is not safe for the EMS workers. So we have now cross-trained New Orleans police officers in life-saving treatments. So if EMS is not allowed on a scene or if NOPD is on the scene first, officers are able to provide life-sustaining methods and life-sustaining means to persons who have been victims of oftentimes violent crimes where every minute counts, Tommy, every minute.
So there
and
might be...
Also,
go ahead, Melanie, I didn't mean to interrupt. No, I'm just saying, so it's a situation where maybe the shooter might still be around. I don't know what's going on. A crime scene's not secure, but somebody needs help. So rather than wait until it's safe for EMT, that's when the police take over?
Absolutely, and that's a great example where a drone would be a wonderful tool to have. Right now, if a call comes out, you have to wait, obviously, for the officer or the EMS or the fire department to come on scene and to begin making assessments. Because drones can get to scenes so much more quickly, then you have an eye in the sky that can tell you the scene is secure or the scene is not secure. We need EMS. We need fire. Perhaps there's traffic. Perhaps there's a different way we need to route emergency vehicles to get to you and to save your life.
When it comes to money, how do you guys raise your money?
We are primarily funded through private donors.
And if somebody wants to get involved with that, how would they do it?
They just go to nopjf.org. We have an online donation process, and they can donate to any of their favorite NOPD districts or units or projects, including if they are interested in supporting drones as first responders.
So getting back to what we were talking about, some of the other things you're helping with, one of them is to train officers as, medical respondents?
Correct, emergency medical responders.
And what are some of the other things, Melanie, you all are looking at or doing or have done?
Well, you know what, we're working on a project right now. The New Orleans Police Department has put out an alert for a missing individual. I believe he's a young man of about 22 years old. And one of the things the Police Foundation does is we work in partnership with Lamar Billboards and with Ring. We push out that information so that it can go up on billboards across the city and beyond. And so that if the individual happened to be on a Ring camera somewhere, that they also might be located. The individual that NOPD is searching for right now is Kamon Terrell. We do believe he is in danger. So So we hope that we find him quickly and safely and bring him home.
You guys help at Mardi Gras, too. You do a lot of stuff, don't you?
We do a lot at Mardi Gras, including making sure all of our first responders, be they New Orleans Police Department or visiting law enforcement, have food and hydration, get a chance to get off the street where they can, get some rest, and get back to it. Because it takes a lot to ensure the revelry of Mardi Gras and that everyone is safe and secure.
If somebody's listening and they're on a fence right now about donating or not, what would you tell them?
I would tell them absolutely. You know, we have seen tremendous progress in the New Orleans Police Department. In 2022, with some political, some public safety strategists that the Police Foundation engaged, we started to see a reduction in crime. Chief Kirkpatrick has come. She built on that foundation. She brought her own strategies. And we are seeing it, Tommy. We're seeing it work year over year. Violent crime numbers going down year over year. Homicides, armed robberies. The list goes on. Chief Kirkpatrick and her team are doing an incredible job, but we are all feeling the crunch of the fiscal crisis, and they are going to need our help. So if you are able to assist canine, mounted officers in your district, we would encourage you to do so.
And that would be how? A cash donation? Or how do they send a check somewhere? What are they? I'm trying to raise some money for you here, Melanie. I'm trying to.
I appreciate that. Yes, we can go online. The website is NOPJF, as in New Orleans Police Justice Foundation, .org. And it's a very easy process to go online. You put in your credit card and you make a donation. Every dime fights crime. Every dime. No donation is too small, Tommy. No donation.
Thank you, Melanie. I appreciate it. That and your efforts.
All right. Thank you, Tommy. We appreciate everything you do as well.
Thank you. Melanie Italia, President and CEO of the New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation, making our way through this Tuesday morning, August the 18th. We started talking to Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director, talking about LSU fall practice and a video that was posted that Lane Kiffin wasn't crazy about that was taken down. You can go back, listen to that if you like. Cameron Henry was with us, Louisiana State Senator and Senate President. We spoke with him about the convention center hotel project and some of the details that have to be worked out and how this tax credit thing could go on for 45 years. We talked with David Elias, Dr. David Elias, an orthopedic surgeon with Ortho LA, about Jordan Tyson and his hamstring injury and hamstring injuries in general and why they can be so problematic. Then we talked with Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director, about the joint practices, what he's seen, what stood out to him and what hasn't. Greg Upton, Director of LSU's Energy Institute, was with us talking about wind and how that's dead for all intents and purposes off the coast of the United States. And J.P. Morrell was here talking about the status of the Plaza Tower. And I say all of that because if you missed any of it, it's as easy as using the Rewind feature. Free Odyssey app has a great feature called Rewind. If you missed part of an interview, stepped away during a breaking news story, just jump back and catch exactly what you missed. Download that free Odyssey app, search for WWL, and listen on your schedule. Rewind, another reason why the Odyssey app belongs on your phone. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to keep going with Judy Ho, a licensed clinical psychologist, host of the Savvy Psychologist podcast. And I'm going to get your input on this at 504-260-1870. Half of the parents in the United States say they sometimes go through their kids' phones. Do you? Where's the line between snooping, giving them privacy, and keeping them safe? We'll get some answers, get some tips here, your feedback when we come back on WWL. 9:28 now, talking to Dr. Judy Hoag, licensed clinical psychologist, host of the Savvy Psychologist podcast, our longtime friend. How you doing, Dr. Judy?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How are you?
I'm well. We're going to talk about parents and smartphones, although we're really talking about phones and mental health here for the most part, aren't we?
Of course. Everyone's favorite topic.
Tell me about how they can negatively impact kids.
Well, the thing is that phones are just so high stimuli and things are happening so fast and people can scroll and switch in between content really fast and also simultaneously look at a bunch of content at the same time. And what we know about developing brains especially is that it will oftentimes impede the proper development of our executive functions and our attention stores. So even as adults, you know, we may feel sometimes overwhelmed by all of that. And as children because the brains are still under construction, it has a bigger impact that could end up carrying into other things that they need to do throughout the day, the tasks that they need to complete, and also just contributes to a sense of feeling overwhelmed, rushed, like there's just too much going on at the same time.
And even phone is a misnomer because it's really like carrying a little computer around with you. That's what we're talking about.
Exactly. I know it's so complicated. I still remember when we had, you know, rotary phones in the home.
No,
really,
you don't.
Phone,
you
right?
might remember
yes,
push button.
Do.
You don't remember rotary phones.
I had a rotary phone when I was very
really?
Little growing up in Taiwan.
Wow. No
oh,
kidding.
Yes. There's a picture of me with it when I was like 4 years old.
So it's not all bad. It can be good, right?
Of course. I mean, phones, you know, again, like you just said, phones are a little computer. So there's a lot that we can accomplish with our phones. But I think a lot of people are not necessarily using their phones for productivity. And even sometimes the productivity apps on a phone can get kind of overwhelming. Like there's just too many things happening.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, phones help us keep in touch. Phones help us to stay on top of the news and any updates. All those things are great. But I also have people complaining that they feel like they're too connected. Like sometimes they really just want to be away from their phones, but people always know how to reach them even when they're on a vacation. You know, and this applies to kids too, right? I mean, maybe they are trying to just, you know, have a nice day with the family. But, you know, they keep checking Instagram or TikTok to see what they're missing because they know that their friends are out today and they're worried that their friends are doing something super fun without them. And that contributes to anxiety and that feeling of FOMO that a lot of people complain about.
And as far as super fun, I'd put that in quotation marks because, you know, 12 seconds might look like super fun, but that's just 12 seconds out of God knows how much, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that that is, unfortunately, you know, you fill in the blanks, right? You see the 12 seconds on a reel or on a TikTok video, but you fill in the blanks of, oh my gosh, you know, and when the camera's not on, they're saying this or doing that, and I'm missing all of it.
It's just like a TV program is what it is, and I don't think kids realize that. Is there something parents can do or should do, like at what's age appropriate for a child to sit down and say, look, now, here's the deal. What you're watching is not real. In a way it is, but in a way it's not, and at some point they have to have a reality check, right? It seems like earlier would be better than later.
Oh, definitely. But I think that it can be tough, right? Because sometimes when you have that talk with your kids, they think that you're the one who's out of touch. You have no idea what they're going through. And, you know, to an extent, they're probably right. And also, once you start to talk to them in a sort of, you know, I got to talk to you, this is a lecture kind of way, they just kind of tune you out. Mm-hmm. And so I think that you got to find that right approach. And I think so much of it really revolves around staying curious and being curious about their habits, why they use the phone, you know, why they're interested, but not making it seem like an interrogation and seem more like a conversation where you're trying to learn about their interests, why they use the phone, why it's important to them, you know, what they think the benefits are. I think that it has to sort of bridge that feeling of I'm getting a lecture from my parents to, oh, my mom and my dad, they just really want to know about my life.
As you say that, I'm just thinking about the conversation, how it's evolved through the years with the phones. And you know, I've been watching Breaking Bad and what's the other one? Better Call Saul. And they got their old flip phones, right? And you think about how much that's changed with the iPhone, a smartphone. And then the concern used to be with predators and young people, and it still is. But now it's almost the threat is not as much a predator as much as it is just the social backlash, right? One way or the other?
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of times people are thinking about, you know, of course, those dangers, those big dangers that you just mentioned. But it's also the fact that with our phones, we're constantly feeling connected to anything that might be going on, any potential gossip, people bullying you in the comments, you know, making snide remarks, making you feel bad about yourself. And sometimes they're even sending things more in a direct message. Or if you're using Snapchat, whatever mean thing they said about you, it goes away after a period of time and you can't even track it. And so I think that all of that adds up to a lot of pressure, and could have really significant mental health consequences, especially for our young people, because at a certain age, we care about peer influence and we care about peer interactions much more so than we do as adults. And that's that time when all these comments matter so much more.
You have a soon-to-be five-year-old, right?
My child is four and a half.
Soon-to-be five.
I mean, he already is feeling some. Yeah, he's about to be five. Exactly.
Soon to be five.
You know, he's already feels. Yeah, he's going to be five in November. So yeah. he already has feelings of social pressure and influence.
Like, really?
You know, well, why can't so and so play with me longer? Well, we're at a play date, but he's spending more time with the other kid. You know, things like that. That's already happening at his age.
How do you go about introducing the whole thing with a child to a phone? Is there any data that shows there's an age that's appropriate or not, or does it depend on the child?
I think it really depends on the child. And I was actually having this conversation, interestingly, with my child's optometrist last week. And, you know, she has a toddler and she's like, well, any parent who can not give their kid any screen time, kudos to them, because I don't know how that's possible. That's probably pretty hard to do. She's like, but more importantly, if you're trying to protect their eyes, and she's talking obviously about their eye health, she's like, well, you just want to keep things at a certain distance, you know, make sure they're not looking at it too closely. And of course, like, take breaks. I think that every family is going to have their idea about this, because there are health and mental health effects of having too much screen time too young. But I also think that when parents judge other parents for having their child use screen time, you know, that's not very helpful, because I think that most people need it just to get a break. Like, if you want to wash the dishes or clean up before bedtime, you know, you need to have, you know, YouTube babysitter maybe for like 20 minutes while you're doing all of that. And so I think you have to watch your child. And if your child is showing signs of distress when you try to take away the phone, the YouTube, they're protesting too much, they're starting to act out of sorts, you know, that kind of shows you that they're having some kind of an addiction to it. And it doesn't mean that it's clinical addiction. I'm not trying to diagnose your three-year-old child, but it's more like, wow, if they're having this big of a reaction when you try to take away their phone and they're not like, you know, okay, I don't really want to, but I'll do it, then I think that you're starting to see a problem develop. And that's when you really have to be more strict about enforcing limits and explaining to your child in a way that they can understand their age. Like, it's not great for you to watch, you know, the phone for this long. Let's play something else. Let's do something else. And really making sure that there's variety in their activities.
Somebody texted in, I was talking about Breaking Bad, and they said that smartphones are the electronic crystal meth. We're going to talk about the addictive nature of these things when we come back. Dr. Judy Ho is our friend, our guest, licensed clinical psychologist, host of the Savvy Psychologist podcast. Text me at 504-260-1870. If you got kids in school, tell me how you handle their phone usage, how you monitor it, and do you check their phones? Because, again, back in the day, it used to be, let's check to see what you're looking at, predators, keystroke programs, etc. But now it seems as though the conversation has shifted from that to bullying and your friends trashing you on social media, or the thing of thinking everybody's life is better than yours because you're seeing this little 12-second snippet that in no way is real life. 504-260-1870 if you want to get involved. 937 23 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. 944 16 till 10. Talking to our friend Dr. Judy Ho, licensed clinical psychologist, host of the Savvy Psychologist podcast, about smartphones and parents and kids. And Dr. Judy, somebody texted in and said they want to go through their kid's phone to see what they're up to. Talking about a 15-year-old girl here, but the kid being the 15-year-old girl, but they don't know what to look for. And that's a good point, because I mentioned back in the day it used to be, you know, predators or maybe Chris Hansen and looking for some old guy trying to pick him up or something like that. But now there's a lot more threats than that, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it can be really tough because there's a new app coming out all the time, and it's just impossible for you to always be fully informed on everything that's going on. But, you know, there are some websites for parents to know about kids' apps, basically. And I don't know that they're always going to be 100% ahead of the game, but there's several different websites that essentially educate parents about the kind of apps that are out there. There's also some parental control apps to manage screen time and how they access things. But, you know, I think the most important thing is if your child is living under your roof, then there has to be certain rules. Like, I can check your phone anytime I want, and I need to have passwords to all of your apps. And I think that that's a reasonable thing to ask, because it's your money, it's your house, right? They're living with your rules. And if they want to have a phone, then the, you know, as a balance to that privilege, you need to be able to have access to anything that you want to look at. So if you, you know, of course, it doesn't prevent them from trying to delete an app before you go and look at it. But still, if you're looking at their phone and you're trying to get into an app and you can't open it, you know, you can request that they put their password in so you can look at it. And I think that that's very reasonable. I don't think that that's overbearing, because I think that you need to have parental monitoring. I think you and I have talked about this before, Tommy, but parental monitoring is one of the biggest predictors of good functioning in children and adolescents. You know, just the fact that you're on top of what they're doing and you're asking questions.
Somebody texted in about the addictive part of it, the difference between habit and addiction, and is there anything that indicates, and I know you and I have had this conversation before, but with dopamine and so forth, there is an addictive nature to whatever it is that social media is feeding you through the phone, right?
Yes, definitely. And it's because the quickness of how you get emotional and sensory rewards from using phone and apps and how they're designed, they are a bit unnatural in a way, right? It's not giving your dopamine sort of the type of spike that it would regularly have if it was just exposed to, you know, a really fun activity, a great meal, a great laugh with your friends. Like, there's dopamine spikes there too, but they don't spike it so quickly. And, you know, I think some researchers, which I think they're trying to make a point, it sounds very severe, but what they're saying is the level of dopamine spikes in terms of how significant they are, they're starting to replicate in some ways what alcohol and substances do when we use them. And so this is the part of the addictive nature, or like gambling, for example, or internet gaming, like all of these activities that have shown to have addictive qualities. It's because they spike the dopamine in such a large magnitude that your brain then starts to become addicted to that, right? It is not satisfied anymore the next time you just have a great laugh with your friends or go out for a nice meal. It wants that bigger dopamine kick. And then your brain starts to get more and more used to that. So your brain builds tolerance and it needs to be bigger and better the next time. And so, and the apps are always trying to make them bigger and better because they want your attention. And so, you know, we're not making app makers out to be like horrible human beings. I mean, obviously there's great apps out there too, but they are trying to tap into that particular, you know, human drive of wanting to feel good. And dopamine is a feel good as well as a motivational chemical. So it motivates you to do that same behavior next time to get that same high, if you will.
Somebody texted in and wants to know the best way to go about their kid getting some negative feedback from friends on social media.
Yeah, it's really hard, right? Because I think that that's going to happen to everybody who uses social media at any point. And I think it's really important to normalize the behavior, but not discount it. So, you know, yes, you know, this is not, you're not the only person this is happening to, but not like this is no big deal, right? So you're not the only person that this is happening to, you know, but we know you're suffering. And what can we do to help you with that? You know, is it better that you just kind of take a break and don't look at it for a little while? Is it that maybe you need to reevaluate who are your real friends if they're saying this about you? Or do you want to actually have a direct talk about whoever's spreading this rumor if you have that relationship with them? I think it's important to help them problem solve it, but without actually doing it for them. And the answer might not be just, you know, well, this is why we don't use social media. I mean, that's not really a great lesson. I think that that's also unrealistic for most people. They're going to use social media. And so it's more about like, how can we use it in a way that's more responsible? And if these people are toxic, if these people are making you feel this way, then do you want to be friends with them? You know, like, do you want to rethink your friendship, maybe hang out with another group of people who might not say this about you behind your back or to your face on social media? And I think that that will help at least start the conversation.
Well, they are family, so no, I'm kidding. When it comes to the age thing and kids, somebody texted in, basically what they're asking is it possible to raise a child today without a smartphone? Because they're going to be kind of like left out of the loop, right?
Yeah, but I also know that there's a lot of people who don't give their teens smartphones, and they're just used to that as a way of life. And it, you know, you can give them a phone for emergencies, right? They should be able to contact you when they need you, but they don't need a smartphone for that, right? And so I think that you might feel like your child is missing out. They may tell you that they're missing out, but I also know many parents who are successfully raising their teens and their teens don't have phones and they're doing really well. And so I think it's really about your own parenting philosophy and also maybe reevaluating your own anxiety about it. Like, do you think that you're not going to, you know, be on top of everything if they don't have a phone? Or is it that, you know, you don't want them to miss out, but it's your anxiety that's overriding the fact that there are kids living without phones? So I would say talk to parents who have done it both ways. You know, if you need a little bit more advice or just guidance on what works, talk to some parents who don't give their kids phones and see how they manage and how their kids are doing.
I want to do a quick poll here at 504-260-1870. If y'all know of any teenagers that don't have a phone, because I don't. Do you, Dr. Judy?
I do, yeah.
You do, really?
Yeah, I can think of literally five families off of the top
really?
Of my head right now.
Teenagers kids, with
I mean,
no phones?
Their child. Yep, and they're like 14, 15 years old. Their kids are between the ages of 13 to 15, and they don't have phones. They don't have smartphones.
Anybody's doing fine?
They just borrow their parents' phones to do things. Yeah, they'll like use their parents' phone to text their friends. You know, they'll play games on their parents' phone. I've just seen them do that.
Somebody else texted in. They said, what's the best way to handle being involved in a negative chat? Do you call the other people out or do you just not take part in it?
Yeah, I mean,
I guess they're talking about where five people are on a chat.
Yeah.
Trash and yeah. The sixth person that's not there.
Yeah. I mean, if it was me, I would say something, but not to shame people. I would just say, hey, like, I'm, you know, well, like, you know, I'd rather not talk about that. Or like, that's pretty mean, guys. I mean, I wouldn't make a big deal out of it, but I would kind of call them out at least to say, I don't like this behavior and I'm not going to participate in it. But I also think that it's totally fair if you want to really confront them about it, and maybe not even on the chat, maybe the next time you see them, that's another way to have that conversation. Because otherwise people get defensive, right? Especially in a group environment. And then the other thing is, if it feels better, just ignore it and not be part of it. Don't be part of that chat. When they're talking that way, that's okay too. I think that's defensible. But if you have a feeling about it and you don't want to be part of that, there's different ways so that you don't have to be complicit in that behavior. And, you know, it's a little bit like groupthink. One person will say something mean, the other person says it, and the ha-ha, everybody's laughing about it, and then people just kind of keep going. And I think that is how gossip starts, and that is how you hurt people, because eventually the person you're talking about finds out about it.
Is there a rule of thumb when it comes to time, or is that all individual?
I think it's individual, but you need to also realize that so much of it is about variety. So sometimes people will say, well, but my kids finished their homework, so I just let them play video games for 4 hours. I mean, there's 4 hours of free time. If there's 4 hours of free time, not all of it needs to be video games, right? It could be 1 hour video games and 3 hours of other things. And so the biggest thing is about variety, to stimulate your brain in different ways other than with this kind of unnatural way that's very stimulating and very fun, but also, you know, you need to be able to walk away from that. So I don't know if you know this about me, Tommy, but I really love video games. But thankfully, I tend to like the video games where you can dip in and out of them, like the old school, like Street Fighter or Tekken games, like things that you kind of play naturally for 15, 20 minutes and it's easy to step out of it. Mm-hmm. But obviously right now, there's so many games that are so involved, and apps are like this too. And the app game, you can play an app game for 6 hours. And so setting a timer is a good way to do it when you're a parent and just say, you got 30 minutes of phone time, go ahead, you know, and just kind of making that a routine. I think that can be really helpful. And then having other activities around so that they can choose other things to do, and giving them a couple of options.
If you don't want them to do it, don't do it yourself.
Yeah, you're still modeling it for them, right? So if you're saying, hey, you can't use the phone for 4 hours, but you are, you're using the phone for 4 hours and it's not for work, then I think you need to evaluate where you can really set your own limits so that your child can follow your example.
Are these behaviors any different than they used to be, or just magnified because of social media?
I think that there's an actual difference, because there just wasn't access to this kind of thing before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I was a teenager, we started using dial-up modems to get online. That was a huge breakthrough. But before then, we weren't at our computers that much, you know? I mean, we played like Oregon Trail. Do you remember that? That was a game on the computer.
You had to actually work.
But it's such a slow...
If you want to trash somebody.
Game.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's too much work. So it's a completely qualitatively different thing that we're dealing with now.
Thank you, Dr. Judy. I appreciate it. As always, Dr. Judy Ho, licensed clinical psychologist, host of the Savvy Psychologist podcast, 956. We'll find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL. Talk with Dr. Judy about going through your kids' phones.